Good evening. So this is our final talk on wise effort after a month-long exploration. Next month we'll go into wise mindfulness, then wise concentration, and that will finish up our year-long exploration of the Four Noble Truths. So hopefully you found this to be a very fruitful year, as Thueri and I both have. Now if you look at wise effort, we often look at it in isolation, but that one in particular is really connected with the other folds. You can't separate it out as a separate thing and still have its full meaning. It really works with these other elements of the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. You can see how interwoven and interconnected, interdependent they really are. In particular, we can look at wise view, wise effort, and wise mindfulness as this kind of threesome that work to activate all the other factors, to kind of bring them to life, help us engage with them, you know, in a very concrete way. It's a little bit like if you're trying to make a bread, you need, you know, water and flour, but also yeast and enough, the right temperature and sugar and kneading it, and also time. So you put all these factors together at the right ratio, and you can have a lovely loaf of bread. You take one of those factors out, and the bread won't work so well. So these three factors of wise view, wise effort, and wise mindfulness work with the other Eightfold Path to really activate them, to bring them to life. And just like with a bread, if you have good ingredients, clear, you know, wholesome ingredients, you have a good outcome. So too is our refinement and our understanding of these path factors start to grow, so too does our practice. Now there's a sutta called the Great 40 that you can find in the middle length discourses in the Majjhima Nikaya. And this offers a nice description of how these three factors work together. That's the sutta referenced in the homework. Now in that sutta, it basically talks about these three qualities, a right view, right effort, and right mindfulness, run and circle around the other path factors of view, of intention, of speech, of action, and livelihood. So you pulled out those, the action component of the Eightfold Path and also the wisdom component. So these three factors run circles around. So what does that mean? I was talking to someone before and she was saying, this is a little vague what that means, running circles around. Now running circles around brings to mind a sense of like a herding dog that's running in circles around a herd of cattle to kind of direct them where it's a better place to be. For those of you here last 2 weekends ago with Christina Feldman, she was talking about how the analogy of a cow was often used in the suttas because it was a very agrarian culture. You know, it was a very accessible image to see cows walking around doing their business. And cows, if you've ever been out in the country or lived in the country or been, you know, hiking in the country and been around cows, you know how they kind of just go where they want, right? They go over here and they munch on this grass, and they go over there, and without a lot of, you know, oversight. And then we have to kind of define, like maybe through fences or a sense of like a herding dog to kind of train them to where to go or clue them where to go. So this image of the cow represents our own untrained mind and how, left to its own devices, it kind of goes into fields which sometimes are helpful and sometimes not. You know, the fields of fantasy, of worry, of anxiety. You know, you get a sense of what I'm talking about. That we can often, those image of the cow is going into this field that may not be so helpful. So the sense of how do we kind of herd that, those herds of cows, of our impulses, of our untrained mind, in a way that helps to align us with the Four Noble Truths. The sense of going into fields which may not be so nourishing or helpful. I remember reading something about a, you know, particular plant that if a cow ate, it would be poisonous. So I was looking it up online and found actually 47 plants that were dangerous to cows. And so it's like, okay, that's a good analogy, how cows can get into, cattle can get into vegetation that's not so helpful, driven by their impulses, their desire and the lack of discernment. So this is where we have the image of the cattle dog come in. The dog that's trained to herd and direct the cattle, keep them safe, put them into places that is going to be nourishing, the fields which are nourishing. You think about the image of a cattle dog, they have to have three components. They have to have a quality of discernment, of knowing what's good, what's beneficial, and what's not. And that sense of clarity of mind. They also have to have application of effort. How do they actually engage with the cows in a way that's the cows will respond and not panic, that they'll be responsive to that herding. And then finally, they need to have a quality of paying attention. They can't just be lost in, a daydream. They have to be attentive to that herd that they're watching. So this is the analogy of running circles around these factors, that we need to have that quality of wise view, of discernment. We have to have the quality of effort, of how do we actually engage with helpful, skillful action. And then finally, that sense of mindfulness, that sense of paying attention, even though we may be distracted or confused about what's happening. Like many of suttas, there's kind of a core formula that's applied to different things. And the Buddha was very comprehensive. He would often take something and just look at every aspect that you could possibly think of. There's a comprehensive way of looking at it. So he goes through in this sutta these five aspects of view, of intention, of speech, action, and livelihood. And so let's focus just on a little bit of this formula and see how it helps us understand how wise action or wise effort fits in with these other two factors, and how it can't be kind of separated out and still be so effective. So this formula, we can see how these three together, of view, of effort, and mindfulness, all work together around these other aspects of the folds of the Eightfold Path. So first, looking at view. So the quote, I'll just quote a little bit of the sutta, because sometimes it's a little hard to hear the whole sutta all at once. So right view is the forerunner. And how is right view the forerunner? One discerns wrong view, and right view as right view. Okay, pretty simple. That, view basically has this discernment, like what's wise and what's unwise. That's very simple. That's applied to these other qualities of, so it starts with view, wise intention, what's wise intention, what's unwise intention, what's unwise speech, what's wise speech, what's wise action and wise action, wise livelihood and wise livelihood. So you get a sense how this one formula is applied to these different aspects. Now the forerunner piece, I think, is a key part. Right view is the forerunner. So it's really where everything starts. That view of where do we operate from. You can think of it as this deep underlying premise of how we view the world and how we view ourselves within that world. So if you think of it in that way, there's always some view that's operating through, that's driving our actions, that's informing our actions. It's like this underlying premise, our hypothesis, that we build our whole assumption of how things are, how things work in the world. So let's say our premise is that there's not enough, that there's a lack, right? Then actions that flow from that, stealing make more sense. Maybe being deceitful make more sense. You have to kind of protect your limited resources. Perhaps a sense of alienation, of not being belonging. And from that view, from that belief system, then certain actions make sense. Right? And when the wise part, the wise view, comes from this understanding of what causes suffering, the Four Noble Truths, this discernment of really what is the almost atomic reasons that, you know, the very atomic level reasons of why we create suffering in our lives, and learning to understand that in a very deep way. That's a simple way to understand wise view, is understanding the Four Noble Truths. Now, when you hear that, though, there's a little bit of a hitch with that for me. Because it's fine to say that as a view. Okay, that's, I need to understand what wise view is by understanding the Four Noble Truths. But how does that show up in the heat of the moment? In the heat of the moment when I'm having an argument with someone, when I'm feeling charged, when I'm feeling triggered, reactive. You know, when I'm in the worst moments, when that's how does that show up? I can't say, okay, wait a second. Okay, the first noble truth is that there's dukkha, and there's the origination of dukkha, and there's... Okay, this is what I'm going to say. You know, you can't take the time to do that. You need some kind of way to access it in a moment-by-moment, real-time way. A way of integrating it in a way that actually shows up in those heated times. You know, a way to find discernment in the middle of life. In the middle, in the very real conflicts that we deal with, the very real choices we deal with moment after moment. You know, how do we parent? How do we engage in our relationships? How do we engage in our choices that we make in our lives? And so, starting to get a sense of the origin of what, that impulse of action. In some ways, the view itself that you are operating from is sometimes a little hard to see, unless we really look and train ourselves to see that. But the impulse often has this kind of flavoring that we can kind of get a better sense of. This impulse of what's causing our action. You know, what does this feel like? And the body is a wonderful guide for that. Because we can go into our minds, our intellect around it, kind of rationalize why it's okay to take the candy from the trick-or-treater or something like that. But that sense of, you're a hard audience tonight. So the body's a wonderful guide because it has a certain honesty, a certain integrity that you can't deny. What I mean by that is if you're feeling like, you know, taking something that's not freely offered, you might be able to rationalize, like, well, you know, I didn't take it last time, and all these other people have so much, and I have so little, and whatever rationale we have. But if we just shift from the thought stream into the actual body experience, there's a dissonance. There's a sense of, this doesn't feel quite right. Even something that might be difficult to do, there's a way of like, this feels like this, I feel subtle, I can feel almost the gravity going through my body. Okay, I feel myself grounded on the earth. And that sense becomes a very helpful guide. We have to learn to trust that more and more. Instead of trusting the analysis or the rationale or the justification. You know, if you've ever talked to someone who's, you know, feeling, you know, is being dishonest or being deceitful, they often can really spin quite a story. You know, there's an elaboration. Sometimes we can find ourselves engaging in that way. So we're trying to figure out as a way to sense whether this impulse to act, to think, to do something, or even to view the world, our intentionality, is coming from these deep roots of ignorance, of delusion, of greed, and hatred. So those are kind of these big roots that sometimes is a little off-putting when you hear greed, hatred, and delusion. Christina was talking also about how those are sometimes harder to access, but the sense of hindrances are much more accessible. That, yeah, I feel craving, I feel aversion, I feel restlessness, sleepiness, worried, doubt. And those are manifestations of these deeper roots. So anytime you feel that quality of struggle, it's very helpful to look and see what's driving this. What's the engine that's driving it? So is it coming from greed and hatred and delusion? Or is it coming from a sense of wisdom and compassion? It's almost like the sense of the engine that moves us and the fuel that we use. And we get a sense of that, that's actually much more accessible in the moment, because it's not so much based on at the intellectual understanding of the teachings. It's something we can feel very viscerally. So we can think of ourselves as almost having two, you know, in a very simplified way, two modes of being in the world. One is acting from the world of a untransformed thought and mind. Okay, so from this mode, some of the languages we're thinking about future, thinking about past, the sense of time is very concrete there, and including the sense of impatience and boredom. You know, I need to get, you know, get through this so I can get to my next thing, right? Or, you know, I want this to last forever. So time comes into this belief, this view, this mode of thinking, moving from thought. There's a sense of looking at life and seeing what's incomplete, insufficient, you know, externally and internally. There's things from this logic, there's things to judge, there's things to criticize, there's things to fix, things that we lack, that's what we need. The things we lack, or if we have those, we'll feel happy. The things that we don't like, if we get rid of those, then we'll be happy. This is kind of the logic of this whole mode of thought and mind-driven life. You know, again, the untransformed or unclarified quality of that. Certainly thought can be very helpful and very beautiful in our lives, very insightful. But there's often a very destructive or neurotic aspect. If anyone who's, you know, tried sitting and watching their thoughts, you know how random the thoughts can be, how reactive they can be, and how unreliable they can be. We have this idea of how something is, and then we actually see it for real. Oh, I was mistaken about that. So the mode of thought and this sense of thinking, it really creates our world view. Right? This is kind of where that sense of view comes in. If we invest in our beliefs and our reactivity and our deep conditioning, that paints the world in a certain way. The other mode is out of the heart. Especially the purified heart or the transformed heart, the wise heart, that actually has a very different language. And if the mind is of time, then this is of the timeless, of the immediacy of the moment. If the mind sees unsatisfactoriness, there's a complete sufficiency of the heart, a completeness. If the mind is of judgment and harshness and criticism, the heart is of love. Acceptance, receiving. If the mind is of thought, of elaboration, the heart is of stillness and quiet, wordlessness. So the sense of the heart orientation, you know, is not a foreign thing to us. It happens spontaneously at different times in our lives. You know, seeing, you know, my newborn daughter when she was born, you know, being on the bedside of someone who's dying, there can be a deep stillness, an immediacy that there's, it's like the moment is so full, there's not room to interject thought over it. The heart is just lighting up with that experience. Sometimes the beauty of nature can bring this forth. And I can't say any word, any description takes me a little bit away from that immediate experience. Rumi speaks of it this way: out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there's a field. I'll meet you there. And when the soul lies down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about. Ideas, language, even the phrase each other doesn't make any sense. So the recognition of which mode are we coming from is very key to this whole sense of discernment, wise effort, and wise mindfulness. Because if we're trying to come from this view of isolation, of contraction, it's not going to be wise. It's not going to be aligned with the Four Noble Truths. It might be somewhat aligned, but it won't. Eventually it will start, the dissonance will become more and more apparent, more and more clear. And as we practice, that clarity of which mode are we coming from does become more obvious, more undeniable. It's really the sense of the fuel that I'm operating from. You know, when you're feeling angry, when you're feeling hurt and you want to lash out, notice the energy behind that, noticing the world view behind that. When you're feeling generous and kind, when you're feeling safe and protected and at ease, there's a different relationship that comes out. This is what I'm talking about, this kind of mode that you operate from. As our practice matures, we start to learn to distrust the world of thought more and more. Because we see that when I act from that, it causes suffering. It causes hardship for myself and for others. It becomes more and more clear. And the more sensitive you get as you practice, you feel the ripples of that action. It's like you stop harming, it's because you don't want to harm, but also just the effects of the harm are painful. You feel that more and more in your own heart. And you also start to trust this world of the heart more and more. Because you also see that when I act from that way, there's peace, there's kindness. People respond in a different way. My own body responds in a different way. So it becomes more and more obvious that this way leads to suffering, this way leads to peace. This is the heart of this discernment, this, you know, what's wise and what's unwise. So as this discernment starts to happen, we see how right view is the forerunner. And how right view is how is it the forerunner? One discerns wrong view is wrong view, and right view is right view. One discerns wise intention and wrong intention, wise speech, wrong speech, and onward. So as this happens, and we start to bring both effort and mindfulness start to come into play. So wise view kind of orients, okay, which is the right path? Which is the right direction? If you don't have that discernment, it's like the herding dog doesn't know what to do with the cows. It's like, oh yeah, you should go eat that poisonous hemlock and that's fine. Or, you know, that grass field is down to the nubs and it's going to be damaged from that. You know, there's a wisdom that comes in. And so once that herding dog of our wise view comes in with discernment, then wise effort has to have a skillfulness to it. Because if that dog was snapping at the heels and caused a panic, that would not be helpful. There's a right amount of effort to get the cows to respond. There's a right amount of effort to get our attention, our minds to respond. Sometimes it's more energy, isn't it? When you're just lost in thought, and every second it feels like you're getting driven to thought, you come back again and again. Other times it's much more quiet, much more subtle. It's a different quality of effort. That's why effort, it's just like you're fine-tuning it to what the moment is needing. If the effort is too vague or undefined, that's also not so helpful. It's as if the dog was kind of like, oh yeah, you can go wherever you want. It's not so helpful for the cows. So the sutta continues, one makes an effort for the abandoning of wrong view and for the entering into right view. This is one's right effort. So again, for the right view includes intention, view, intention, speech, action, and livelihood. So we're kind of taking each of those folds and applying the same formula too. So it depends again on the recognition of what's right and wrong, what's wise and unwise. Now that right and wrong is sometimes a word that we are a little allergic to borrow Christina's phrase. It's because it kind of echoes that sense of being you're wrong, that your test score was wrong or your answer was wrong, and therefore you're wrong, or that I'm right and you're wrong. That kind of duality, I think, resonates a little bit in an unhealthy way for us. But you can also think of it just, there's a clarity, like, okay, is this going toward peace, toward freedom, or going toward suffering? The suffering is the wrong view, is the unwise view, the unwholesome view. suffering or freedom, peace, is the wise or right view. So the sense of abandoning wrong view, how do you do that? How do you abandon it? Beginning getting that sense of what the impulse that's driving you is. Is it from lack of, from a sense of lack, of separation, of isolation, of hatred, of greed, of delusion? Is it coming from the quality of the hindrances? Is that what's driving your impulse in the moment? Okay, so when it's really flared up, much of wise effort is learning how to let those flames quiet down. To let those flames cool down, let the hot spots start to chill out a little bit. Right? So there's a sense of calming the mind, calming. There's a phrase in the Satipatthana, you know, breathing in, calming the fabrications, calming that investment, that tightening around. Okay, so as we, you probably have noticed, as you meditate, it does have this calming effect, this cooling effect. It brings this pause into our reactivity. If you want to really beef up our reactivity, just, you know, you just jump into it. You know, you just say the first word that's in your mouth, and you just get someone else's reaction, and then pretty soon you have a nice little fight going. So the cooling down those flames starts to allow a clearer seeing to emerge, a more accurate seeing. Because we're in the midst of a reactivity, we can't see very well. It's like we're so, you know, like we have that fog of rage or of fear that really literally obscures our vision, obscures how we see. And so that clarity of vision then leads to this next aspect of wise mindfulness, of the ability to make contact with the moment's experience, with a sensation, with a thought, with an emotion, with someone else, in a way that's not distorted by our preconceptions, not distorted by our reactivity. It actually has a quality of friendliness, of connection. In that quality, we can actually see more fully and more completely. So one is mindful to abandon wrong view and to enter and remain in right view. This is one's right mindfulness. Again, right view, intention, speech, action, livelihood. Now the effort for entering into right view, and we talked about the sense of abandoning, you know, we find ourselves, okay, this engine of fear, of pain is really driving me. Okay, I need to pause, I need to come back into the body, allow things to cool down so I can see more clearly. But when things are cool, how do you actually enter into wise view, to wise speech, to wise intention, wise action, wise livelihood? You know, what's that mechanism? And this is very interesting because it's a different level of, different quality of effort than we are used to. That's why the first talk of this month series, I asked us to kind of reflect on what our relationship to the word effort is. What's our background history? Because we're not clear about that. We're just going to unconsciously apply that. It's almost a given that we'll use our normal strategies of applying effort. You know, how many of you have meditated and felt a sense of harshness that you got lost in thought? Like, oh, you know, I got lost in thought. Come back. You're supposed to be on your breath. I mean, that's an application of effort, but it's embedded in our, you know, really our archaic wounding, our whole way of learning to kind of keep ourselves in check. It's not helpful in the practice. It actually creates a lot of background tension and makes it much harder for the practice to mature, to open. So a different kind of effort is needed. It's like trying to yell at someone to relax. You know, it's like trying to force yourself to let go. You know, force yourself to, you know, to surrender, to, you know, to listen. It's like all these things we can't force ourselves. It's like trying to grasp at peace. Okay, I'm going to be peaceful. I'm going to try really hard to be peaceful, be tranquil. You know, really try hard. It doesn't work. But we will keep trying that strategy until we start to bring the perspective of really wise effort, wise view, and wise mindfulness into balance this whole process. And so then we start to move to a different quality that's beyond our normal will, our normal egoic strategies. Certainly they've served us. Sometimes they served us as young children. Sometimes they've served us in our adult roles, sometimes better than others, other times. But the practice gets to the point we can't keep using that same strategy. So things like surrender and release, they start to come from a different place than our normal will. There's a story, a Zen story, that I appreciate, and I'll kind of paraphrase it. Then in this country a long time ago, there was this group, a clan or a guild of musicians. And so they, you know, loved to celebrate music and the different instruments. And this one person came from a different country with this new kind of flute and, you know, played it. And after that person played it, the whole room was completely silent. Just, they were just into awe of how beautiful that was played. And finally, one of the elders said, "Like a god." And that was played like a god. And so the group of musicians say, "Okay, we've got to learn how to do this. So we'll pick our most talented musician and give them money to go study with this master." So the student came, was a really good student, already very accomplished. And the teacher gave him the music and said, "Okay, practice this. And, you know, I'll teach you this." And so the musician practiced it very diligently, you know, got so it was technically perfect, and then went to show the master. And the master said, "Something lacking. Something's missing." And so the student went back and redoubled their efforts, did it again and again, and the story kept going. "Something's lacking. Not quite there." And it went on for, you know, months and months. And so finally the student became just so discouraged and actually slunk away in the middle of the night and couldn't go back to the village because he hadn't been given this certificate, and ended up being wandering homeless and just kind of making a little bit of money playing for the children and teaching the lessons. And eventually he kind of wandered back to the original village years later. And that same group of musicians were having another gathering. And they begged him to come and said, "You know, the past is gone. You know, don't worry about that failure. Just come, please. Play for us." And the musician came and brought his instrument, the flute that he was supposed to learn. So he had gone to this point of complete exhausting his normal willful strategy of applying his effort, of trying to force his way through it. And he had nothing left to lose. He was in rags, full of shame, and just, "Okay, I'll let that all go." And he played the flute. And at the end, it was complete silence. And the elder said, "Like a god." So this is this sense of effort that sometimes we have to exhaust the possibility of our normal strategies. Sometimes we're stubborn and it gets to like almost a crisis and we say, "Okay, I can't do this anymore." Then something else has to take over. We can also make it a little easier process by not being so stubborn. Meister Eckhart, who's a Christian mystic from many centuries ago, has a beautiful way of describing this process of practice. And as you listen to this, so that, you know, it does use the word God, so translate that however you like, that works for your own sense. When I hear the word God, I think of the deepest level of stillness. "One should love God mindlessly. By this I mean that your soul ought to be without mind or mental activities or images or representations. Bear your soul of all mind and stay there without mind. Moreover, I advise you to let your own being you sink away and melt into God's being God. In this way, your you and God's her would become a completely one my, and you'll come to know her changeless existence and her nameless nothingness." So as you hear those words, you get this sense of this deep alignment of wise effort. That's not you trying to attain something, you trying to gain something, but a surrender that's so profound. Surrender thought, surrender the sense of even you as a separate seeker. So wise effort. And then the final aspect, one is mindful to abandon wrong view and to enter and remain in right view. This is one's right mindfulness. So again, wise, right effort, you know, all those different aspects. So this is the quality of attention that attends without preconception, without judgment. There's this direct seeing. And it has a spectrum, doesn't it? Sometimes mindfulness is much more of, okay, I have to come back from my distractions. I have to learn to steady my attention. But that's the beginning. The practice deepens into this much more quiet level of effort, quiet level of seeing, all informed by wise view. So wise view, wise effort, wise mindfulness do work all together. They run together around these circles to help kind of bring this mind from this being untrained and wild to orienting it toward the path toward liberation. And just to read this whole section that we've been talking about, again, I use wise view, but again, wise view, wise intention, speech, action, and livelihood. Right view is the forerunner. And how is right view the forerunner? By discerning wrong view as wrong view, and right view as right view. One makes an effort for the abandoning of wrong view and for entering into right view. This is one's right effort. One is mindful to abandon wrong view and to enter and remain in right view. This is one's right mindfulness. Thus, these three qualities, right view, right effort, and right mindfulness, run in circle around right view. All right, let's just sit quietly for a few moments and let those words settle. Right now in this moment, notice how whatever is most present, it could be the body, it could be thought, it could be this a breath, a sound. And there's this background sense of view of how you're relating to this, perhaps of irritation, of boredom, perhaps of peace, of calmness. And that view then sets the stage of how do we relate to it? Do we steady our attention? Do we relax into it? What's the effort that is wise? What is the wise mindfulness in this moment arising? Thank you for your kind attention. I'd just like to say a few words about the practice and reflection sheet, so hopefully it makes a little bit more sense now, having talked about this. So reflect on how right view, right effort, and right mindfulness run in circle around the path factors. Okay, the path factors of view, intention, of speech, action, and livelihood. And what happens when one of these three are not present? You know, if the view is not aligned, if the mindfulness isn't there, if the effort isn't aligned, how does that change how those path factors come to life? How do they feel that sense of alignment with the Four Noble Truths? And how does this work within the day-to-day choices of acting from wisdom and compassion or acting from greed, hatred, and delusion? I mean, these choices happen all the time. Someone cuts you off on the freeway. You feel irritated. That's right in front of you. You have a choice. And this practice is about learning to see those choice points. If you choose to act from that irritation and act that out, you're reinforcing those deep patterns of greed, hatred, and delusion. You're reinforcing your suffering. If you act from a place of compassion, of discernment, of wisdom, that's reinforcing the quality of wisdom that aligns you with the path of the Dharma. So yeah, make an experiment, play with this. And I know this is a little obtuse perhaps, but hopefully with a little bit of effort it will make sense. So let's open up to any comments or questions about the talk or about anything. Yes, Iris.
One comment that it's sort of so wonderful that we have the option to make a choice in every moment. I mean, you know, that's sort of kind of radical thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because so often I'm just sort of driven by my mind.
Right.
And when I can slow down a bit and when I feel the suffering,
yes. Yeah, so the comment is around, it's wonderful to realize there is a choice, that we don't have to be driven by our reactivity, by our suffering, and that being able to slow down allows that choice to come. And that piece about slowing down is so essential. Because sometimes it doesn't feel like we have the choice, does it? We're just kind of caught in the reactivity and the urgency of the moment. I was just teaching at Cloud Mountain this last weekend, and I do this practice that Narayan taught me, is that when people hear the bell to have people come back from walking, instead of hearing the bell and then hurrying back, the practice is just to completely pause, to literally stop wherever you are, whatever you're doing, and just come into this place of stillness. And this is a beautiful training because we can be still, we can be moving, and we can be still but still very active in our heads. And if we can hear the bell and actually be really internally still, that teaches us this ability of kind of releasing our reactivity. At first we have to make it a more conscious, kind of intentional process. But after a while, it becomes very, you can do it almost in a half a second. Just this touching into feeling the feet touching the ground, feeling a breath. And that little bit of pause makes the whole difference. You know, if we're caught in this reactivity cycle, there's no space in there, but just a little bit of space allows that choice to come in. And then you listen to the heart, like, okay, what action aligns with the most wisdom that I can bring forth? The most compassion I can bring forth in this moment. Remembering action includes not only what you say, what you do, but also what you think. Wouldn't that be radical, that every time you had a thought that you paused? Is this a thought that leads toward more suffering? Is this a thought that leads toward more liberation? Your minds would become very quiet. Yes.
I had a question. I was thinking about what you said and in your visual mind, kind of applying effort, like those normal strategies.
Yes.
And the story to present story told, kind of the theme of like being able to surrender
Yes, yes.
And I found, just personally in my practice, sometimes I am able to kind of access that ability to just let go and apply effort on a more subtle level, and sometimes I'm not, and I'm present and I create that
yes,
space.
Yes.
So with that, there's still kind of the attention and the activity.
Yes. Yeah, that's a nice question. So to paraphrase it for the recording and make sure I capture the essence of it, the sense of our habitual way of relating to practice, sometimes it's our, you know, our way of working with effort kind of feeds in there. And there's times when we can consciously just say, I'm going to release this, I'm going to surrender, and it works. Other times, it's like you can say, okay, I have to surrender, and it doesn't work, that there's a tightening, there's a restriction. What's the difference between those two? Is that, yeah.
I mean, I can feel the difference, but I don't understand the difference being able to actually apply that skill or not. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so it's not so much, I mean, you can obviously feel the difference, but more the why is it sometimes you can apply the skill of releasing and other times you can't. Yeah, so that, it's really important question because it's like we kind of, the practice is kind of full of sets up for failure, a wise failure. You know, like we start from the day one, like, okay, just notice your breath and let go of thought. That's simple said, right? But how hard is that to do, right? So, you know, we have to learn how to come back to our breath and our thoughts keep coming by, and sometimes the thoughts are so strong. You know, something like that is a simple example. Sometimes there's a sense of holding an agenda, of wanting things to be a certain way, or holding that sense of resentment or anger towards someone else, that sense of self-hatred toward yourself, you know, and how it's, you know that that's not helpful, it's painful, why can't I just let that go, right? And the reason is that there's more identification with it. There's more of a sense of you, that's who you are in some way. You're believing, that's the why, the wrong view has kind of is being operating at that point. Now the tricky thing is to not see that as something that's a failure in your practice, but actually as a gift. So what I mean by that, it's like we set this intention, okay, I'm gonna ski down the slope this way and I keep going off this way. Instead of saying, no, I'm messing up, it's more like, oh, why am I going off this way? What is there to understand here? That's why the mindfulness instinct starts to bring these qualities of investigation also. To say, okay, let me, and just like you said, you know, sometimes you just have to sit with it. So you sit with that sense of, okay, I'm really angry at this person. I feel really hurt and I can't let go of that. Okay, then you start to befriend that very quality of being hurt. Okay, let me relax with that. And I don't want to, it hurts. I was like, okay, but that's where the wise effort is. Relaxing with it, feeling it more fully as a body experience, starting to hear the more subtle beliefs that are around it, the ones that you don't know are there. And when you start to see those, you start to see it a more complete way. And when you start to see it so completely, then the identification starts to lift from it. So basically when we're stuck, it's because there's like this tendril of identification with it. And until we see that, it's going to still be stuck. But instead of arguing and being upset that that's there, it's more like a gift to start to see where the identification is. And once you kind of follow that down a few times, you start to get this very different confidence with working with those stick spots. You actually say, oh, thank you, that's great that I got really triggered by that. And it's a chance to really see, okay, where am I identified? Because when you see through it to the point where the identification falls away, there's a deep peace that comes from that. You can actually feel there's more space, there's more liberation, there's more freedom. You know, you have to realize this, we're not talking about a few minute process. It could be a few hours, a few days, a few months, a few years, you know, depending on how strong it is. And it may feel like you've fully seen it, and then it comes up in a different way. It's like, okay. That's why there's a huge amount of patience that's embedded in this wise effort. Yeah, you're welcome. Yes.
I listened to the last two comments. I was reminded of this morning. I was commuting to work and I was meditating on you. And it was actually going pretty well. And then, you know, someone, that person who's right behind me, zipped into the other lane and zipped into the very reasonable space I was keeping between myself. And I started to imagine all these things about, well, that person's obviously, they're going to get into a wreck soon. You know, they've been to that lane, they don't know that lane's slow. I'm just going to zoom by them. You know, I had all these feelings. And I was sitting with them, you know, and I became mindful again. I was like, oh, look at me doing this. And it occurred, I was reminded of that. Then it occurred to me as I was looking also, you know, the reflection. There's no right feeling. That's not one of the things.
Yes, yeah.
There's an effort, there's an intention. There are all of these things that are about to move the direction to take ourselves. And that can be very helpful to me in not moralizing about the actual reaction.
Nice, yes. That's a nice observation. Let's see if I can capture that for the recording. So, you know, driving to work and, you know, feeling very peaceful in a sense of meditative quality until someone cut you off and, you know, and all the thought streams come up. And that, reflecting on that, you know, noticing the whole reactivity and reflecting on this list of all the different wise this and that, wise feeling isn't one of those, right? There's not a wise emotion. And that's really important because sometimes we're so geared to finding, like, if it feels good, it must be good. If it feels bad, it must be bad, right? And, you know, that sense of we're letting our emotions kind of be a advisor for us and a guide. They certainly have some. There's some alignment that's helpful, but there's also that sense of, you know, this may be very unpleasant. My impulse may be just to kind of rant and rave, and that's where it feels good to do that. But you can't trust that. Really what happens is you start to orient to a much deeper quality of peace, of contentment, of tranquility that you know is often underneath that. And that becomes more important than the short-term expression. Is that kind of what you're talking about? Yeah, good. Yeah, that's a good insight. Yeah, what is left out of this list? Right opinion. Right. Right? Yes, Mark. Or Jonathan, sorry. Jonathan, Mark.
Yeah. Okay, so I hope I can tell this, but it seems to me like there were all those things about, you know, all the trouble, and then I had this problem. And then between that and then immediately, like, a lot of those things just went away completely. Like, you know, all of this action, you know, there was sort of all this and that and all the other things, they were like, yeah, we actually didn't really need that. You know,
right.
It was almost worth it, you know, like the things, and it's still a lot of, and then there's a lot, you know, it's interesting, and then things come back sometimes, and there's a lot of, but it's just a thing where it just shows that all of the things that were normal, the way I lived, were just showed that they didn't have to, I didn't need it there at all, you know, as soon as it was.
Yeah, yeah, thank you for sharing that. So the comment or observation was often we go through life with a certain kind of investment in what we think is important. You know, this sense of, okay, I gotta do this and this and this. And then you have something that's a very big reorientation of that. You have something that just, it brings a level of urgency that there's a finiteness to this life. And there's this reordering of this whole thing. And that's this really, that what you're describing is this this wise view really became, it's like, of course, that's the only thing. The wrong view just fell away. And all the energy behind it, it's like you could just, this doesn't lead anywhere. And that's really the gift of this spiritual urgency. And it is a very precious way to use that. And it's very precious to have the practice at this time. So thank you. All right, anyone else? Yes.
Mm. And I'm not sure why. So for anything that I take on, if I'm not real curious about it, I have to put a whole lot more effort into whatever it is. But if I'm really curious about the subject matter or whatever, there's no effort. I don't feel like there's any effort that's necessary. Can you
So the comment or observation is that when there's a sense of curiosity, there's very little or no effort that's needed to really engage. When there's not the curiosity, then there's a lot of effort that's needed to kind of do what needs to be done or to engage. And why, you know, why is that? And why is there curiosity for some things and not in other things? And so in terms of what makes something curious, sometimes it's, you know, we all, because of our history, we have these kind of hot spots or buttons, basically, that these things that something arises and, oh, you know, we have a matching thing to that. So that's part of that curiosity. But there's this more kind of basic level of curiosity that we start to cultivate as meditative students. And that's something that we can start to apply to things that we don't have those buttons or those hot buttons for. You know, basically it's like the breath. I mean, you know, how many people ever found the breath a little boring? I'm honest here now. You know, and so it's like, you know, this is so boring. But after you practice, there's a way that you start to learn to see through the thought process, which is, this is nothing in here or interesting, to the actual moment by moment expression of that. When you can let go of the thought process to connect with the actual moment, then everything has a certain interest. It can be very curious. It's like if you were like a spouse that you were with for many years, it's like you kind of know how they are. To actually see them in a fresh way means you have to let go of your preconceptions of how they are. So when you're able to either that not arise or there's a sense of, through training to release that, then that sense of curiosity is much more natural. And when we're curious that way, we're naturally already engaged with it. We're already making contact with it. The mindfulness is already, it's not effortful, it's already present. That we're, you know, we're watching the nuances, we're curious about it, we're engaged. And then, you know, the effort, it's not so needed at that point. It's more naturally sustained through the factors of energy, of, you know. And curiosity, I think, is a wonderful thing to work with in our practice. You know, where's their curiosity? Because we're not curious about something we already know. I already got that figured out. I don't have to pay attention to that anymore. But if I don't know it, I actually listen. I say, what is this about? And you actually listen in a different way. So the trick is to regain that for stuff that you already think you know. You're welcome. Yes, Jerry.
It reminded me of the teacher in one of his comments, or when he's supporting us, he says, be curious, investigate, surrender.
Hmm. Yeah, so the comment is that a teacher instructed, be curious, investigate, and surrender. And that really is a nice summation of that, that if you're curious, then you're engaging. And what you're engaging, there's a sense of investigation to know more about it. And then the surrender is like that sense of, you know, we can take that many ways, whether it's something that's unpleasant or something that's difficult, or even that deeper surrender, the sense of me observing. So there becomes no distance between what's seen and what is observing. All right, anything else? Okay, so thank you again for those engaged questions. That really helps to flesh out the topic and really bring it forth alive in your own experience. So a couple short announcements and requests. One is around